Hello, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of That's Bonkers, Bruh, where we talk about the strange and unusual, the interesting, and anything downright bonkers. I'm your host, Mitch.
And I'm Kelsey.
And here we are again, ready to pick up where we left off from last time.
Yeah. On Eclipse Day.
So coincidentally, today is Eclipse Day, and our logo, also an eclipse.
Yeah, and I did not make that connection until you brought it up to me today.
Yeah, it was not intentional.
Kind of interesting that we started our podcast the same year as the eclipse, and just, that is our logo.
Just a handful of weeks ago.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
It was meant to be.
So anyway, what do you got for us today, Mitch? Because last time I did a whole bunch of talking.
All of it.
I did so much talking, and I'm excited to not do as much talking this time, so why don't you enlighten us? What are you going to talk about today?
Yeah. So, like I said last time, this is kind of a continuation of what I felt was a great segue after the Frankie Rose. No.
What?
Ruby Frankie. There we go. Ruby Frankie.
Frankie Rose.
I don't know where I'm going with it. I got frustrated throughout the process of the podcast, thinking about how I wish that someone could have just like intervened sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really thinking that it would be super exciting to talk about some like real life vigilantes.
All right, let's get after it.
So some of this is pretty heavy. So we're going to give a little bit of a trigger warning because we are talking about vigilantes after all. First group is actually called the Sombra Negra or Black Shadow, which to me kind of like same thing, Black Shadow. Anyways, I'm not going to speak ill of this death squad.
Oh.
That's made up of what is believed to be police and military personnel from El Salvador. They target the gangs of MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang. The government, by the way, totally, they're like, we have nothing to do with this. This is not under our control. But also, they don't, what's the word I'm looking for? They don't necessarily, like, discredit or, what's the word I'm thinking of? I can't think of, like, where they don't tell them that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing.
Yeah, it's like a don't ask, don't tell situation.
Don't ask, don't tell. These dudes are can I say loco?
In the cabeza?
Yeah. Like, so, and there is a few things in here that are in Espanol that I'm probably going to butcher. So I apologize in advance.
Well, you've been doing Duolingo for a long time, so you really should have some level of skill.
I try. Anyway, so these, what are believed to be, again, police and military personnel dress up in what's usually like tactical wear type of stuff and cover their faces, everything to keep their identity a secret. They will capture these gang members, known gang members that have partaken in criminal activity, and typically blindfold them, tie their hands. They'll even, I don't know how they do this, but it said that they would tie their thumbs together behind their back, which seems really uncomfortable. Just to like have you're trying to pull away, or if you're a big dude and you just got to keep your thumbs together behind you, and it's just rope or I don't know. Anyways,
I feel like it would be more uncomfortable if it was your pinkies tied together.
Touche.
Maybe they should let me in their group.
Yeah. Well, you gotta be pretty heartless, because what they do is they literally take these gang members through several hours of torture.
Yikes.
Including certain body parts. They'll remove facial features, digits from hands and toes. Also,
ew,
other parts will be removed.
Mitch, that's disturbing.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, why'd you pick such a gross topic?
I didn't know that it was going to be like this. But when you get into it, you're just like, this is wild. Bonkers even, right?
One might say that, yeah.
And so, like, there's this Sombra Negra is so feared that, like, a lot of times, if these gang members from the MS-13 or 18th Street Gang are caught, they'll like beg to be put into prison because that they don't want anything to do with this vigilante group.
Are they catching people and torturing people who actually deserve it, who are actually like really like bad, bad people?
I mean, if you know anything about the MS-13 gang, which actually there's a fairly sizable presence of the MS-13 in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But they're strictly, this Sombra Negra is in El Salvador. But MS-13, as I had come to understand through my research here, is a pretty violent, pretty vile gang group. Like, okay. They're one of the more hardcore. So they're, again, where these guys are considering themselves sort of social justice, social equalizers, if you will, they're definitely not targeting Joe Schmo, some 13-year-old wannabe gangbanger. Like, they're going after hardened criminals.
Okay, gotcha.
So it makes you feel less bad about it, I guess. Still gnarly, nonetheless.
Very gnarly.
The group started in, like, the 80s, and they had claimed that they'd only executed, like, 17 individuals by 95, but you haven't heard anything since. But they are completely feared, even to the point where there was a snippet that I found from an MS-13 gang member that was found in the United States that was about to be deported back to El Salvador, and he pleaded to just be put into prison for life because he was so afraid of Sombra Negra.
I don't blame him.
Anyways, as we continue, after hours of torture and removal of body parts, they finally do...
That's disgusting.
...put a tiros de gracia, or shot of grace, into the base of their skull, execution style.
Hmm.
Then on top of that, they leave notes, sometime painted on them, sometime just like things written on paper, that is, el idiota sufrió una muerte lenta, which means this idiot suffered a slow death.
Ay, caramba.
Right? It's crazy. They believe they are doing social cleansing because they are frustrated with the inability for the police to have control and or enforce the laws of El Salvador.
Wow. Well, if that's not enough to keep you out of a gang, I don't know what is.
So don't join a gang, kids.
Word.
So that was a group, right? Kind of just give you a highlight of what was going on there. But I have a couple of other individuals that are individual.
Do they wear capes?
Vigilantes. No, they're not Batman.
Oh, okay.
We're going to talk about first is Jonathan Keith. I believe it's Idema, also known as Jack. Okay. Jack was born in Poughkeepsie, New York, enlisted in the Army in 1975, and technically qualified for the Special Forces in 77. He has this really big, embellished story about how he served for the Special Forces for 12 years, 22 years of combat training, 18 special ops tours, when in reality, he only served a short period of time. He left the Army and was he wasn't even allowed to reenlist as a Special Forces member because of poor performance.
That's so embarrassing.
Yeah. Special Forces are gnarly, right? It's not for just your average Joe. We're talking like Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, stuff like that, that it's like the best of the best. So you've got to be a superior specimen to not only get in, but to keep your spot.
Oh, okay.
However, one of the captains, Captain John Carlson, said, "Without a doubt, the most unmotivated, unprofessional, immature enlisted man I have ever known."
Wow, what a review.
What a review, right? They gave him an honorable discharge, and he was allowed to join the Army Reserve for a period of time so that he could kind of continue his service. But just, I think they'd had enough of his shenanigans.
I mean, was it honorable? Sounds like they made him the kind of drag his name through the mud.
Well, I don't think he had, obviously, a good reputation, but he... It could have been a dishonorable discharge, and I think... I don't know enough about it, but I think a dishonorable discharge a lot of times can result in a situation where you're put in jail or prison for doing something very bad.
Yeah.
I think just he just wasn't really pulling his weight and was little shady. But that's not the important thing here.
Okay.
Okay. The important thing is this guy took it upon himself after 9/11 to get out there and take matters into his own hands. So 9/11 happened. He ended up traveling to Afghanistan and calling it a humanitarian aid mission. But he was there doing some filming and even had like a little bit of stuff involved with Nat Geo. So he was kind of doing some like documentary type of work. However, there was a lot of individuals within the military. We're talking the big leagues, the groups that really oversee our national security, had big question marks next to his name because they're like, what is this guy really all about? Well, I'll tell you what he was all about. He went behind the scenes, started capturing people, and just led everyone down this rabbit hole of providing him with explosives, lying and impersonating officers. He was able to manipulate people into giving him bomb sniffing dogs. He received support from senior Afghani government security advisors. This was all to like help with house raids.
And he just went out on his own to be a vigilante and was like, hey.
Yeah, exactly. So interesting. Dude literally was out in Afghanistan bamboozling our government as well as others to giving him things, and then he would go on these house raids and capture people and then bring them in and be like, here, I caught you a guy, take care of it. Sometimes it seems like in most situations actually they were like, dude, are you drunk? Like this is not even... a lot of these people were let go. The story just continues. He keeps going on and on, doing these house raids. He makes up a story about an assassination attempt on the senior Afghani government security dude, which is why they provided him with so much support. So he went into Afghanistan through questionable means.
What does that mean?
Well, He ended up... he couldn't get directly into Afghanistan because obviously in the middle of a war, September 11th had taken place and everything like that. So he had to get in through like Uzbekistan, which is relatively close, and didn't have the proper visa to be able to get in. So he was technically detained there for a while, made up some story, figured out how to get out of it, and then ultimately made his way into Afghanistan where he started this own vigilante mission where he just, again... wreaked havoc, all because he thought that he was doing the right thing.
But did he actually catch people that they wanted? Like, did he actually do good, or was he just...
I think...
dicking around.
There wasn't enough information that I could find where they were like, this guy did some serious good. I think more than anything, they just continued to want to sort of drag his name through the mud, because he just had a... from what I understand, a pretty larger-than-life personality, but at the end of the day, was just sort of a narcissistic sociopath.
But he wanted to do good, or did he just want the accolades?
I think he had good intentions, but definitely wanted recognition, because he would, again, he would find these individuals and take them a lot of the times to the U.S. military and be like, look, I caught this guy, you know, give me a pat on the back. Sometimes it was for money. Like his rap sheet was a mile long because he did take a bunch of money. He impersonated an officer. The thing that really brought him to justice was arrested in July of 2004. So this had already gone on for 2.5 years or more of him just doing this stuff in Afghanistan. and was ultimately found guilty because they had found his own personal prison.
Gosh.
Where he had kept 8 men that were bound and some others that were dead and hanging by their feet.
Ew.
So he had captured some of these individuals. I don't know. They didn't release the identities at length about what these individuals were that he had caught, but he had captured several men using some of his special forces training and everything like that. And made his own prison out of this hut that was just what he was keeping with some other people that he had bamboozled into believing he was.
So was he actually catching bad people, or was he just human hunting?
Great question.
That's the question. Was he a vigilante bounty hunter type, or was he actually just a serial killer in disguise?
Well, I think.
You know what I mean?
I understand what you're saying. And I don't want to by any means say that I am a full supporter of Jack here, because I do think that his means were a little bit questionable.
Yeah, sounds like it.
However, I believe that when you look under the hood a little bit, he did have, whether he was good at it or not, he had special forces training. And so I think that he probably had enough intelligence to kind of understand what was going on. But was he just catching regular old Afghanis?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Or was it actually bad people?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, what a hobby to have.
Right? For years.
People think podcasting is a weird hobby. This takes the cake.
Yeah. Well, on top of that, some of the things that got him in trouble was that he actually had created and sold tapes to publishers he claimed showing was an Al-Qaeda training camp in action. The tapes showed men in camouflage, tunics, and ski masks storming buildings, practicing drive-by shootings, and attacking golf courses. CBS bought the rights to broadcast the tapes before any other network. They were used in a 60 Minutes episode called Heart of Darkness in January 2002. CBS presented Idema and the tapes he supplied as reliable. He went on to make more money from other tapes when he sold the rights to... he went on to make more money by selling the same tapes to be rebroadcast to the Boston Globe, MSNBC, NBC, ABC, BBC, and others.
Wow.
You ready for this part, though?
Yeah.
The authenticity of the several hours of tape is disputed because the supposed tactics shown are not actually used by Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda fighters shown in the footage also occasionally communicated in English and laughed a lot, providing credence to the notion that the tapes were staged.
Wow. So he just made a bunch of money because he sold this all?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So
people are idiots.
On one hand, you're like, you go, man. You get those bad guys. But yeah, ultimately, he'd been charged with conspiracy, wire fraud, torture, impersonating an officer. The guy also had spent time as a playboy with men, women, and trans women.
Okay.
Where he had contracted AIDS. And that was actually his demise. After they let him out of prison, he spent a handful of years, let him out of prison, and he fled to Mexico, where he died in 2012 of AIDS.
Hmm. Damn.
Right?
What a life.
What a life to live.
That's wild.
This last one's my favorite, though.
Okay,
Can we talk about this one?
Yeah.
Okay, before we get into it, what is one of our favorite shows of all time?
I don't know. We have a lot. The King of Queens.
Okay.
I'm watching a lot.
Sorry, let's go. One of our favorite dramas of all time that you need a quality premium network to watch.
I don't know. I didn't know I was going to be quizzed on this podcast. I don't even know. When do we ever watch dramas? All we watch is comedies.
We do watch a lot of comedy.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, let me give you a hint.
Oh my gosh.
I'm just going to tell you. One of my favorite shows.
That sounds better.
One of my favorite shows of all time is Dexter.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And this last guy is literally the real life Dexter.
Okay. 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 Now I know where we're going.
It's again, kind of a heavy topic. Not going to lie, because we're talking about a vigilante.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like this guy has something going for him, more so than Jack Idema. Are you ready to hear about him?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I've been ready.
So this guy is actually Brazilian. He's not a local guy, not from Florida, not living in the Glades like Dexter.
Okay.
Or he wasn't in Dexter. He was in Miami. Dexter was in Miami.
Yeah.
There was the Glades. Anyway, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, anyway.
All right. Pedro Rodriguez Filho. This guy had just a rough start from the very beginning. You want to know why?
Yeah.
Well, he was born with a bruised and injured skull. Why, you ask?
Why?
His father kicked his mother in the stomach while she was pregnant.
Oh my gosh, what a grade A jackass.
Yeah, it gets... The guy's a real piece of shit. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, if that wasn't bad enough to mark him as a piece of shit, you just wait.
Okay.
So anyways, Pedro's born, kind of a troubled youth, but he ends up actually having his first, we'll call it semi-vigilante experience at the age of 14.
Why? Isn't that kind of similar to Dexter too? He started like, well, no, it was like that he started killing...
It was like animals and stuff.
And then when he was like a teenager and then his dad was like trying to hone it.
The code.
To kill only bad. Okay, anyway.
Taught him the code. Mm-hmm. This guy didn't have a code from what I understand. But just fascinating, right? So at 14 years old, he killed his first individual. He walked in to a board meeting and used his father's rifle to shoot the deputy mayor right there.
Oh, wow.
In the board meeting. Why, you ask? Because his father was fired. He was a school security guard. His father was.
Mm-hmm.
He was accused of stealing food from the school's kitchen. So Pedro walks in, shoots the deputy mayor, already knew who the guy was, another guard that was stealing the food, and killed him.
Oh my gosh. So then what happened to him? Did he go to jail?
14 years old. No, he got out of there. Fled. Ran. Right?
Okay.
He was on the run for several years because this was 14. And I don't think he went to prison for the first time until he was like 19 or 20. Like he had gotten away with some shit for a while.
How do you just be on the run and get away when you're that young, when you're 14? Because like, I mean, you don't have money, you don't have a job. Like,
I mean, I've never been, but like this is Brazil. And I've heard Brazil has some gnarly areas in it. Anyways.
But still, though, what does that have to do? How would he survive? That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'll tell you how he survived. He survived by robbing and killing drug dealers along the way.
Oh,
so
damn.
He would take their money, do whatever he could, earning him the nickname Pedrino Matador, which means little Petey killer. He did this for, like I said, several years. Somewhere along the way, obviously, you know, they quit looking for him for a bit, whatever else. He ended up falling in love with a woman and they started living together. He had still kept up with the sort of vigilante robbing of drug dens and killing dealers and stuff like that, which obviously put a target on him because his girlfriend, who was pregnant at the time, was actually killed by a gang member.
Oh, no.
So what did... What did Pedrino Matador do?
What did he do?
He tracked him down and tortured and killed not just the individual, but every single member in the gang in the whole area.
God, so he's just like a professional badass?
Just picking people off left and right until he found the guy that ultimately killed his girlfriend and eradicated a gang in an area.
Wow. It kind of sounds like Law Abiding Citizen.
Yeah, kind of. And it gets better. Ready?
Or worse, I guess.
Well, yeah, it depends on how you look at it. So he finally does, after this incident, get picked up by police. He's thrown in the back of a cop car with another criminal. And he's taken to jail. When they get to jail, they open the door and find out that the other criminal is dead.
Oh my gosh.
Didn't hear a thing, but the criminal's dead. When asked what happened, Pedro said, "I killed him because I found out he was a rapist." Just cold-blooded, killed him. Rapist.
How did he kill him? Was this guy huge?
Like... No. I went and looked him up. Like, just... he's covered in tats and stuff, but, like, he just seems... I don't want to say thin, but, like, he's not big at all.
Like, how does he just, like, kill all these people? How does he have this, like, special set of skills?
I mean, look at Liam Neeson.
I know, but, like... he has a special set of skills. How does he do it? Like, how does he kill all these people? And no one can, like, fight him off?
It gets better. That's the thing is, I don't know, but this dude is just a bad mofo.
He's a bamf?
He's a bamf.
All right.
Anyways, he's in prison, right? And unfortunately, while he's in prison, you know how I said father was a real jackass?
Mm-hmm.
Father ended up murdering his mother with a machete.
That'll cause some childhood trauma.
Yeah. I mean, this was when he was in prison, right?
Yeah, I know.
So he's in prison. He's 19, 20-ish years old. They did let him out to go to his mother's funeral, and there was, like, an incident where he said he kind of, like, looked over the coffin to, like, view her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then heard the clanking and looked down, and it was, like, a reminder that he was still detained. Like, he was still in his handcuffs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he knew that it was time for vengeance once again because his father was brought to the same prison that he was.
Oh, wow.
So he devised a plan, figured out what he needed to do so that he could get to the same place that his father was.
I mean, yeah, the prison should have seen that one coming.
Should have saw it coming a mile away.
Yeah, what did they think was going to happen?
Probably not what happened. His father ended up getting stabbed 22 times. And then he ripped his heart out and took a bite of it.
Wow, that escalated.
You ready for this quote? I found this quote. I'm sure it's a little off because it had to be translated from Portuguese, but it says, "I killed my father in prison. I was already in prison then. I've spent 42 years in prison. My father was in prison. I arranged a well-thought-out plan and turned up in my father's cell. I had promised revenge on my mother's coffin." And then it said, you know, he ripped his father's heart out, took a bite of it. "I just chewed it," he said. "I cut the tip of the heart off and chewed it and threw it on top of his body."
Savage.
Signed, sealed, delivered.
Signed, sealed, delivered.
Just, and then while he's in prison, right?
If that's not a big F you, I don't know what is.
There's nothing more bold. Now, you would think that they'd put this guy somewhere else, right? On his way to prison, killed a rapist. Killed his father in prison. No, while he was in there, he killed 47 more inmates.
Is he just, like, freakishly strong? Is he, like, possessed by the devil? Like, what? I don't understand why he has this ability.
We'll post some pictures. I'll show you. But just looking at him, you're just like, yeah, just kind of a normal dude. Like, he just, I want to say hatred in his heart, but that actually takes me to the next point here. That kind of despite him having a "Mato por Prazer" tattoo on his chest that says, "I kill for pleasure."
Yikes.
He does say that, like, no, you know, my whole thing was never about doing this for pleasure. I just knew that I needed to cleanse the earth of the bad people and everything like that. So he, for the acts that he had carried out from early on, where he'd killed that deputy mayor, killed the security guard, killed gang members, everything up until that point, he was given 128 years in prison. They're going to increase it to 400 because of the additional people that he killed in prison. But because of Brazilian law, they can only keep you in prison in, I guess, a lump sum for about 30 years.
Really?
Yeah. So he spent 30 years for his early on doings, an additional handful of years, like 4 or 5, for killing the inmates in prison. Got out for a while, had to go back for a few small things. I say small things. It was like he had started a riot. He had possession of deadly weapons and stuff like that. Went back for a few more years. So that's where you get the 42 years in prison. But what is really interesting, and this is what was captivating to me, is that he gets out of prison, becomes a YouTuber. Oh. From 2018 to 2023. I tried to look at some of the videos, but it's all in Portuguese, so it's really hard to follow.
Yeah.
Even with reading subtitles on some of them, it's really hard to follow. And he becomes something of like an anti-crime advocate. So on his YouTube, which is Pedrino X Matador, if you want to look it up. He talks a little bit about the current events, what he thinks should be done, gives some examples of his life and what his rationale was while he was going all through this. And kind of, I don't want to say he was starting to live a more quiet life, but I think he'd sort of put the vigilanteism behind him and was just focused on trying to reduce the crime in Brazil. His YouTube channel was cut short because just over a year ago, March 5th, 2023, he was shot and killed by two assailants. They pulled up to his house in an unmarked car, masks covering their face, shot him a handful of times and drove off, and they have never figured out who had done it.
Wow.
So there is your real life Dexter.
Well, I was going to say, should we be alarmed that we're talking about him on our podcast? He's going to hunt us down if we don't speak highly of him, but I guess never mind.
We're good. I thought about that. It's like, in all of these instances, I was like, I definitely want to make sure that just in case Jack or Pedro hop on and listen to That's Bonkers, Bruh.
I doubt they would.
But both are gone.
Huh. Wow.
So,
okay, I have a question about the jail thing. Like,
okay.
How you said they can only hold them in jail consecutively for like 30 years or whatever.
Yep.
So if you get sentenced to like 120 years or whatever, so essentially a life sentence, like no matter what you do, you're only serving 30, or you would serve 30 years, get out for a time, and then go back later to serve the rest of your sentence, like 30 years at a time? Or do you not know?
No, I from what I understand, so it did say in the article that I read, the articles that I read, that it's increased from 30 to 40 now, so it's up to 40. But I think like for any given case, so even if you're charged with like a dozen counts of first degree murder, the most you're going to stay in prison is 40 years. Now, if you get out and you screw up again, they can send you back for another 40 years. But from what I understand, it's just Brazilian law. They're not never going to keep someone in prison for 128 years.
Hmm. That's kind of crazy because, like, if you were a serial killer and you went away when you were 20... you would still get out with plenty of life left to kill more people.
Plenty.
That's wild.
You know, I don't know this about Brazil at all. So anyone that does, feel free to let us know.
Yeah, we could be totally wrong. We don't even know what we're talking about.
But I can't help but wonder if Brazil is a country that is really looking to like reform, right? I know that we've watched some stuff before, you and I, about how they're really big on reform and like Northern European prisons like Norway and Sweden and stuff like that, where they're it's almost like they're living in a dormitory and like they're really trying to figure out how to reform criminals rather than just make them lifelong criminals.
I just can't imagine that a Brazilian jail is like the one in Norway. I just can't imagine those are the same things. The jail in Norway looks like a freaking IKEA setup.
It does. I've stayed
in Airbnbs worse than a Norway jail, so
it's true.
I don't think the Brazilian jails are that way, but okay.
I could be wrong. I don't know.
Okay. But
Anyways, that's what I got for you.
Wow, that was interesting.
Lots of crazy stuff.
That's really crazy. Like,
again, it was super exciting to learn about because I watched all the seasons of Dexter. So good.
Yeah, we did. We were very invested. All right. Well, I guess I'll move on to my topic.
Fire away, sis.
I don't have a ton. Mine won't be as long as yours. But we just went to Charleston, South Carolina over Easter. And it's a very old city, very cool city if you haven't been there. And that's kind of what has inspired my topic today. Because one of the things we did, we took a haunted carriage ride thing. Is that what it's called? You looked at me like I had two heads all of a sudden. So I thought I said something wrong.
No, just like a, carriage.
Yeah. So, and it talked about like some history and some ghost type stuff. And so I decided I'm going to do some Charleston inspired ghost stories. All right.
I'm ready.
You ready for it? Let me pull up my notes. All right. First one. This took place in the Unitarian Church graveyard. Okay, so this is a love story, and it all began in 1827 between Edgar Poe and Annabel Lee. Edgar was a young, strapping sailor whom Annabel fell madly in love with. As all great love stories go, her father did not approve of their love affair. As such, the most discreet place they could steal moments to spend time together was at the Unitarian Church graveyard. Edgar was eventually dispatched elsewhere. In a cruel twist of fate, Annabel contracted yellow fever and died. When the forlorn sailor returned to pay his final respects, her father foiled his attempts and kept the location of her final resting place a secret. Heartbroken, he wrote a poem to pay tribute to her. He described feeling Annabel's beautiful bright eyes looking at him. Visitors to this graveyard report that they generally feel like someone's watching them every time they venture to that side of town. So she's one of the ghosts that typically haunts that area. And when we went on this tour, he had a lot of stories about yellow fever, because apparently that was like a huge thing over there, like in the 1800s. And a lot of times they would think people were dead and they really weren't dead.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And then they would like get buried alive.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then they'd like open the coffin for whatever reason, and there'd be like scratch marks on the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, yellow fever sounds gnarly.
Yeah, because like a lot of, they said that it was because the doctors didn't want to contract yellow fever either.
Yeah.
They would have the wife go over and like check the pulse or whatever. And he was like, so make sure you take care of your wife, because she could ultimately be like, oh yeah, he's dead. And they would take him and just dump him in a coffin. And then, like, exhume the body later for research.
And they would check it by putting, like, a mirror on a long stick or something like that underneath their nose to see if it would fog up from their breath. And, I guess sometimes they were just, like, unconscious. And they were like, I mean, it seems so wild to me that that could happen. Like, you can't feel for a pulse. I don't know. Did we not know about a pulse back then?
I just think they were too afraid to get that close.
I don't know. I guess that's
true. Because it was pretty deadly.
All right, well, I did a little research on yellow fever. It sounds terrifying. And between 1792 and 1800, yellow fever epidemic struck 7 times. It came common once again from the 1820s to the 1870s and was particularly severe in the 1850s. And I found one extremely creepy story about a lady who had yellow fever that was buried alive. I'm going to read that for you now. Her name was Julia. I'm not sure how to say her last name. Julia Legar, maybe? That's what we'll say it is, but apologies if it's wrong. Okay, so this heartbreaking story of Julia Legar takes place in the southern portion of Charleston County back in the mid-1800s. Julia was visiting family on Edisto Island when she became very ill and fell into a deep coma. Many believe she had become paralyzed and showed no signs of recovery. After weeks of waiting, Julia was pronounced dead and was put in the Legar family mausoleum at the Presbyterian Church on Edisto Island. Embalming methods were not used during this period of time, so the deceased were buried rather quickly before they began to decompose. As such, Legar was placed in the tomb the day she had been pronounced dead, and the mausoleum was sealed. Following the death of the family, or following the death of a family member some years later, the tomb was reopened so they could put this new family member in. But there behind the crypt door was the decayed remains of Julia.
So scratching at the door.
No, she. So it's like a mausoleum. So it's like a big thing above ground. And there's like a big stone door over it. Mm-hmm. So they put her in there. She awoke from her coma and was trying to get out. So she was right behind the door. Like her remains were there on the floor. Not where they put her.
Wow.
Because she had woken up from her coma at some point and was like trying to get out. Okay, I'm not done though. Yeah, new fear unlocked. Like, that's like, that would be the worst way to die. Okay, it was apparent a terrible mistake was made. Julia had been buried alive and awoke from her coma to find herself trapped behind the mausoleum's heavy marble door. Julia was placed back into the tomb, but from that point forward, the doors of the crypt would never remain closed. Heartbroken over what had happened to poor Julia, the family visited the tomb often to pay their respects and were often shocked to find the door was open. Again and again, family members and caretakers would find the doors to the crypt on the ground. No matter how they tried to reinforce the door, chains, locks, bricks, concrete, the door would not stay closed. Visit the tomb even now and you'll find an open door. Many believe Julia stands guard to make sure she is never trapped behind the door that claimed her life so many years ago.
That's gnarly.
Yeah. How bad would you feel as the family members to be like, oh, let's go bury Uncle Jerry now or put him in the mausoleum? And then you open the door and you're like, oh, shit. She wasn't dead. Here, we didn't place her here.
That's so wild and terrifying.
Yeah. So I wish I would have known about this story when we were there. I'm not sure where this is exactly, but I want to go find it and see if the door is open. Apparently the door is like always open.
It's kind of fun. Sounds kind of fun. Terrifying, yeah. But fun. But yeah, to be buried alive.
Isn't that dark?
It's like she's just in there for days or who knows how long, right? Like,
I don't know.
Wow.
Crazy. All right, I got one more. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I got one more scary story and then we can all go to bed and have sweet dreams.
Sweet dreams.
All right, here we go. Okay, so this one is about a haunted hotel. It used to be formerly the Citadel Military Academy, and now it's an Embassy Suites Hotel in Charleston. Okay, so amidst the happy tourists and business folks bustling about Embassy Suites Hotel, a gory bit of history dwells. A spirit roams the halls and rooms of this building, the original Citadel, I don't know if I'm saying that right, which was built in 1829 as an arsenal and later became the South Carolina Military Academy. Because of the unchanging style of cadet uniforms, it would be difficult without a detailed investigation to determine from what century he hails. Yet there is one common denominator to this ghost. The top of his head is missing. From varied descriptions, whether from stunned housekeepers or the cardiologist who left screaming in her underwear upon an early morning encounter, it seems his skull cap was shaved off right above the brow. Since this lost cadet, also known as Half Head, was first documented by paranormal researcher Ed Macy, he has become a celebrity. Last October, the Huffington Post declared that this ghost made Embassy Suites the most haunted hotel in the South.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is in Charleston.
Yeah. Apparently.
I mean, we're not staying there, but no, that's I'm not staying exciting. There.
Yeah, because I got this from charlestonmag.com.
That's exciting. Well, I don't know if that's the right choice of word.
Yeah, but I don't know if I could stay in a haunted hotel. I think it'd be cool to tour one.
But get me the hell out of there.
I don't want to sleep there at night because, you know, I'm going to have to pee in the middle of the night. It's going to happen at least once. And I don't want to get up and have to go to the bathroom in a haunted hotel. That's terrifying.
That seems like a lot.
In a haunted bathroom, I'd have to take you in with me. Can you imagine? I have to wake you up and be like, Mitch, I have to pee. Come with me.
It's the third time tonight.
I drank too much water. I'm scared. And when I get nervous, I have to pee more.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I don't want to imagine.
I really wanted to do a haunted jail tour when we were in Charleston. Mm-hmm. But you have to be at least 12 years old to do it, it said online. And so it didn't work with the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're such buzzkills.
They definitely will bring down the fun, funometer.
Just kidding. We still had a good time. But anyway, if you live in the South somewhere and you haven't been to Charleston, it's really cool to check it out. Or just if you're ever coming over this way, it's a cool, cute little place. We took my parents there and we had a good time.
That's great. I mean, you've right on the beach. You've got Isle of Palms and what is the other one? Folly Beach, yeah, or something like that. There's mm-hmm. several beaches you can go to. A lot of history.
Yeah, I just love an old town. I just get like a kick out of like a really old building. I don't know why. It's just,
our kids were captivated with the Magnolia Plantation.
Yeah, that was really cool.
So this is a working plantation. Well, it was a working plantation that they said something about, I think 400 slaves had worked there at any given moment,
if I remember right.
Huge. And now the gardens are beautiful and everything else. It's still technically owned by the family, but they give you a little bit of a tour. You can see where people lived, how they lived, a few backstories. Super interesting to go walk the grounds there to see the old house that was built in the 1800s or whatever. And you're just like, wow, this thing is still in great shape.
It's just crazy people lived that way back then. I don't know. It's just wild. It's just, the whole thing is wild. And the whole time they were talking about it, I just kept thinking, this place has to be haunted.
Oh, I'm sure.
It has to be.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and
I don't know.
So many people were mistreated there. So it's like, it would have to be, I feel like.
Yeah. And I mean, don't want to get on a whole other tangent and draw this thing out for another hour. But this was, they called it, it was a rice plantation. And for a lot of people, they don't understand that Carolinas, especially Charleston, they had Carolina gold rice was grown there. And so the only way to grow rice is in these rice paddies. And, they would have to flood the place up to 3 to 4 feet tall to make sure that the plants were grown underwater or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you flood it in a swamp in South Carolina, you're going to introduce not only bacteria, but little critter friends like giant ass gators and poisonous snakes. So these people were out there farming for rice and getting taken down left and right by
They said the average age was only like 35. Like, people wouldn't usually live past 35 because it was just so dangerous and the conditions were just so harsh.
Yeah, they said it was literally, this rice was expensive as gold. That's why it was the Carolina gold rice, not necessarily because of the color.
Yeah, but isn't it kind of golden color?
It's golden-ish. But yeah, like, it was because it was literally so damn expensive, where they would keep it to send little batches to royalty and stuff like that. Anyways. Yeah,
it was interesting. You could really go off on a tangent if you're not careful.
Me as a whole?
You specifically can get off on tangents about things.
I can.
I wasn't saying that generally. All right. Well, that's all I got. Yeah. So
let's wrap it up.
Yeah, we're going to bed now. So I guess I'll just, on that note.
Sweet ghost dreams.
Yeah, sweet dream. I always have bad dreams, but hopefully you guys aren't listening to this at night, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, well, thanks again, everyone, for listening. Share with your friends, share with your family.
Yep.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.